Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everybody. Hello, and welcome to this morning's podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Rich Shinnick. He is the CEO at a leading cybersecurity firm known as Touchstone Security. They're based out of Allendale, New Jersey. Rich, thanks for your time, and let's go and get started, please.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you for your time. Yeah, we looked up your bio. We did some background snooping on you, and you seem to have a very, very deep and rich background in cybersecurity. And in fact, just before the show started, we were talking about your experience in aeronautical and aerospace. It seems like you have a very rich background. Can you tell us some of the highlights of your career and how you actually ended up in cybersecurity?
Sure. So I've been working on computers since I was about 19, maybe even 18. I worked for a law firm in Manhattan, and they had a data center, and or if you want to call it a data center, they didn't call it a data center back then. They called it the word processing center, and it was a room of desks all, you know, row by row with half the room as typists, so we actually had typewriters. And on the other half were word processing machines that connected up to a mainframe. And most of those computers didn't have hard drives. So this was when the first PC came out where you had the large floppy drives. And it was a very cutting-edge law firm on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. And my job was to scan in documents that were written by lawyers and decide whether they needed to go to a typist or to a word processor and so on. So that's how I got my start. And while there, I was learning about word processing, of course, and as well the mainframe and how to back up the mainframe. And back then we had these platters, which were steel metal disks that looked like the old 33 RPM records. And that was my start. We had a printer that was a copier and a printer online, which 30 plus years ago was quite cutting edge. And we had a optical character recognition machine, which was about the size of a washing machine, and it would scan line by line a piece of paper that was typed and bring it into the word processing system. So optical character recognition goes back a long way as well. Then I went into the Air Force, and that's where I got my first exposure to real computing. And I guess one could call it cyber back then, but it was really more of electronic security, whereby we had SCIFs, these rooms that were lead-lined so that signals don't emanate. We were running fiber optic networks between Zenith workstations, which were running DOS 2.0. So the DOS 2.0, for those who don't know, is the predecessor to Windows. It was the first Microsoft operating system. And I wrote programs in the BASIC language as the learning or training officer. And I would create these tests that one would then take, and then it would give you a grade at the end and let you go back and look at the questions you got wrong, that sort of thing. And I wrote that in BASIC. So that was basically my start, fiber optics being part of the cyber with respect to the electronic aspect of eavesdropping and security. And my job in the Air Force was actually not computing. My job was as a airborne German cryptologic linguist, which is a mouthful, but that was the official title. And what I did was I collected intelligence against East Germans while flying in an airplane in the Baltic Sea. And these sorts of missions still go on today, not against the Germans, of course, but against other countries in the world, adversaries, that sort of thing. And it's a very dangerous job today due to the heightened challenges that we face. But, you know, the shift in warfare today is definitely in the cyberspace, and maybe we can talk a little bit about that or not. But that was my first real exposure to computing, and we had punch cards, but we also had digital drives, removable drives that were, for lack of a better description, the size of an 8-track or the profile of an 8-track tape, but twice the size. So if you remember the 8-track days before cassettes, the hard drives were like, looked just like that, but they were twice the size. Then from there, I worked for the Hospital for Special Surgery. And while there, I learned a lot about networking, a lot about mainframes. I managed a cluster of VACs, VMS systems. I worked on some obscure operating system like Ultrix and a variety of Linux operating systems. And I put my first firewall in place. It was a Linux firewall. And it was for three hospitals that shared a 56K line. Now, a 56K line is not even as much bandwidth as a regular analog phone line, which is 64. So it was not the internet back then. It was used for education, and the Hospital for Special Surgery was one of three hospitals, and most hospitals have an education component with them. So it was for software like Veronica and Archie, some of these softwares that were systems that folks don't even know what they are any longer. They're historical, right? And so I built a firewall and really liked it, really liked the challenge of trying to prevent certain things and understanding how basically TCP/IP operates, right, and how applications work. And a variety of systems worked there. And then I worked for another company thereafter on Wall Street called DNA, Digital Network Associates. That's where I really got my feet seriously wet, because the company was a consultancy firm that catered to the finance industry for the most part. So I was doing work for really large companies down on Wall Street, down in that area, Midtown, and so on. And the primary start focus of the company was to do relocations. So a company's vacating a 60-story building on Broad Street, and they're moving to, you know, a 70-story building, say, in Jersey City or in Midtown, what have you. And I would design and build out the networking for that move, and we would do the soup to nuts. So we would design the data center, we would design the switches, the routers, the connectivity, the servers, and so on. And in doing so, we also did some bleeding-edge e-commerce sites for trading firms. My first real, I guess you could call it a reference account, was National Discount Brokers, NDB. They were one of the very first, very successful discount brokerage firms, online discount brokerage firms. And I designed their e-commerce infrastructure and the connection and security to the internet for doing online trading. And in doing so, one of the other things that myself and a colleague of mine had the honor of doing is we worked on serial number 0 and serial number 1 of the first PIX firewalls, which, for those who know the term PIX, that is a firewall company that Cisco purchased before they were in the firewall business. So I actually worked on the very, very first Cisco firewall. So that's probably the most claim to fame that I could share with you. Thereafter, I worked for Goldman Sachs. I worked in their investment banking division and did the intrusion detection systems in their firewalls. They ran a variety of different technologies there, quite a large environment. But the interesting thing, which surprised me when I was there, was that they had bridged wide area networks. So typically wide area networks, particularly today, are routed. And back then, before routing was very prevalent, it was flat networks. And we may or may not touch on this concept of a flat network. But even today, I come across clients and I do audits, and they're running flat networks. And flat networks do not, by nature, provide segmentation. And segmentation is a component of, cybersecurity. So that was interesting to me, one of the memorable experiences that I have there. After that, I started my first company in 1998 and then started my second company in 2000. Brought on a partner, grew that company, sold it, and started my third company, Touchstone Security. And here I am today.
Yeah, so what was really, you have all this great background. Was that the main catalyst why you started Touchstone, or was there some other driving force behind that?
Well, I was with a partner. I brought on a partner in 2000 and thought it was a good idea. We went 50-50 on the company and grew the company to the point where middle management needed to be put in place. You know, they say the average manager can manage 3 to 7 people, and 5 is the right number, more or less. So you have to put in middle management, and there is this concept of working on your business, not in your business. As an entrepreneur, starting a business, you find yourself working in it. You're delivering services to clients. You're doing all the work. You wear numerous hats. Eventually, though, the company gets too large, and for you to properly grow and manage your company, you need to focus on the company, not working in it. And I was able to accomplish that, but it took quite a bit of arm wrangling, let's just call it. Eventually, I got to the point where my partner and I just didn't see eye to eye, so I decided something had to change. The company was not going to grow to the next level with not seeing eye to eye as far as leadership was concerned. So I had some partner problems, which is not uncommon in the entrepreneurial world. So I decided the easiest path is to start again, which I wasn't really wanting to do, but that's what worked out. So I started Touchdown, and when I decided to start a new company 23 years later after starting my first company, it was a bit of a daunting endeavor because, you know, as you get older, you start to make more money, you start to live a certain lifestyle, and when you start over, it's from the bottom, and no clients, no income, nothing, right? You're starting from scratch. So you have to work on pretty much everything. What's your story? How are you going to differentiate yourself? Where are you going to get your clients? How are you going to get the clients? Who's going to deliver the services? What about insurance? Are you going to get a building, an office? What about computing? There's everything that you have to think about, payroll, insurance. So I took my time in 2017 in the beginning to try to find a name. And quite frankly, I think one of the most difficult things in starting the company was finding a name. There are so many URLs that are taken. You need to have a URL that's memorable. It's nice to have a meaning. I did some research into company names, and one of the things I learned was, or one of the aspects of it is, you want an emotion. If you can get an emotion across in your company name, people can resonate with that, and they identify with an emotion. And I analyzed and thought about what do all the clients that I've had over the years, what do they feel is a value that I provide? What is it that they would describe their relationship with me the most? And it always seemed to have come back to trust. And so I was looking for a name that had the word trust in it, and it was just about impossible. So I'm watching a movie, and at the end of the movie, you see the credits, and Touchdown Pictures comes across. And at this point, this is 6 months into trying to figure out a name, which is some might find quite silly because just pick any name and move on, right? But I was very, you know, I like to do everything perfect. I'm a little bit of an OCD person. Some would say I'm a lot. And so anytime I saw a word that was not commonplace for me, I would try to look at it as potentially part of a name or a name of a company. And when I saw Touchdown Pictures, I was like, Touchdown Security, Touchdown Technology. Let me look that up. And I started to look it up, and there were a few companies that used the name. One in Philadelphia, one out in, I think, Washington State. But there were very few, and they didn't do exactly what I wanted to do. Then I looked up the meaning. I kind of knew what a touchstone was, but I looked up the meaning, and basically a touchstone, if you look in the Webster Dictionary or what have you, is basically a criteria by which others are measured. And it comes from the medieval times where there is a particular type of stone. It's a dark-colored stone. And if you rubbed a precious metal against it, it would indicate whether the metal was high quality or if it was fool's gold or something like that. So it had this somewhat quasi-cyber connotation to it. And I figured, you know, 6 months trying to find a name, there's no one using Touchstone. It might be looked at as a bit of a tongue twister, but it was unique. And if I wanted to play on the origins of the word, I could. I didn't have to, but I could. And so I went forward with it. So that's how I started Touchstone and got the name. And that was one of the biggest challenges. Of course, getting clients was another one, right? So what was I going to do to differentiate myself from other companies? And I put it right on my website, and there's three things that we focus on. One is I'm a veteran, obviously, spent 5 years in the Air Force and had a lot of training there and continued my training afterwards. So I seek out and hire military-trained consultants. So we're military-trained. I don't know how many cyber firms have military-trained consultants. The second thing is deep experience. So almost every one of my employees is in the six-figure range. They are highly seasoned, highly trained consultants, and we want to maintain that level of high-end experience, so we have deep experience. And then the third one is being extremely responsive. And the responsiveness has lent itself well with one of the services we offer, which is ransomware recovery. And unfortunately, due to the nature of ransomware, it's basically thievery, but it does not only, you know, take your money when they demand ransom, but it also disrupts your business severely. And in most cases, from my experience, that is even worse than paying the ransomware, the interruption to your business. Just imagine you're a company of 100 employees and no one's computers work or no one's able to access any data that they use, including email. It's very, very detrimental to businesses, and a fair amount of businesses actually go out of business. So when a company gets ransomware, they know it, and they don't know what to do. It's not something that's commonplace. And so we help within an hour, anywhere in the United States at least, I can be at your doorstep navigating you through. And so we've built a fairly nice practice around ransomware. So responsiveness, it doesn't have to be ransomware. You could have a server down or what have you. You could be in the middle of a project and want someone to answer. So we're a small company, and we're nimble, and we really focus on being responsive to the client.
Okay, excellent. Now, Rich, there are a lot of other MSSPs out there, too. I've interviewed who knows how many in my history of podcasting. Other than what you just mentioned, are there any other differentiating factors to why a potential prospect or client should come to you? So, for example, if it was me, why should I go, hey, Rich, can you service my needs as opposed to these 10 other people that I know?
Great question. So as an MSSP, we're taking on some of the security responsibilities for your environment, the monitoring and the management of the environment. And there are a number of things that have to occur to properly do that. Insurance, security is sort of like insurance, right? You need to buy enough to cover what you need, but you don't want to underpay, you don't want to overpay, you don't want too much insurance. You want the right amount. And an MSSP is sort of like insurance in that you can spend a lot of money doing a lot of different things, or you can underspend and not have the proper controls in place. And it's a very complex endeavor because there's a lot of pieces to it and a lot of overlap and complexity by nature of what it is that it does. So what we do is we do an assessment, and we do it in a economical way, in the sense that if we start to audit a Windows server, let's just use an example. You have a Windows server, whatever it may be. Maybe it's your Active Directory server or your Exchange server. Maybe it's just a file server. In a matter of about 30 minutes, we're going to know whether or not you actually used a hardened build, if you will. You either did or did not execute through some sort of a hardening script like some of the CIS benchmarks that are out there. And at that point, there's no need for us to continue to check all those a thousand boxes, right? We'll stop and we'll just declare this box as not being hardened and move on to the next thing. And we'll look at your network, the design of your network, how it was built. Is it segmented? Is it segmented properly? How are the segments separated? Are they controlled through some firewalling or access control lists? Those sorts of things. We'll look at your authentication, whether you practice least privilege on your access controls of files. Are you using groups? Do you use user accounts that are unique to individuals, or do you have shared accounts? What's your password policy? Some simple stuff some higher end stuff. Are you using BitLocker? And if so, is it the default 128-bit? Or did you actually take the time to do 256, which is what it should be at a very least? Things along those lines. And the experience, our experience comes through when we're doing this. And I think that is a big differentiator, having the experience of having done these sorts of audits and assessments over many, many years and understanding the differences in different technologies. You have networking, you have Windows operating systems, you have Linux operating systems, you have wireless, you know, and the list goes on and on and on. And so we take that experience and have developed an auditing approach, a methodology, as well as a, you know, a roadmap, if you will, of how to go about affecting change in the environment so that you are putting layers of security in place. And so there is reconfiguration. There may be systems that get merged. There may be data sets that are transferred or minimized, things along those lines, as well as network redesign and so on and so forth. So for an MSSP, I think the experience, I think the approach from an economical perspective, I think the roadmap outcome. And then lastly, we work well with MSPs. We work well with IT companies and IT staff. We encourage what I call shoulder surfing, where when we're doing work on your systems, we encourage you to work with us, to watch us, to learn from us. I taught in New York University, and I taught at Columbia University for 9 years. And I enjoy teaching, and I instill that in my employees to share and to do your work in such a way that, you know, there's not only the results of the work, but also the benefit of learning. So we encourage and incorporate learning in all we do as well. So those are a few. I don't know if I'm rambling or not, so let me know. Sometimes I'll just talk and talk and talk.
No, I love your background. I think it's important that we hit on, you know, to really expand what you're, you know, what we're discussing here. But anyway, so who is your typical customer base that you're trying to target? Are we talking about the mom and pop businesses, small, medium-sized, Fortune 500, federal government, or is this a mix and match of everybody? Or really, who's your sweet spot?
Great question. So that actually was one of the things that I had to think about when I wanted to start the company. I've been a member of Entrepreneurs Organization, otherwise known as EO, for 13 years. It is an entrepreneur networking group, but it's quite unique. And one of the things you learn over time as an entrepreneur is how best to distinguish your company and grow it quickly. And one of the things is to be known in an industry or a vertical, right? Focus on a particular vertical, you narrow down your competition, and you become well-known in that vertical. And certain verticals, quite a few verticals, have small worlds, if you will, right? The networking is quite leverageable, if you will. So I took that to mind and looked at my experience, looked at cloud, because one of the differentiators, which I actually neglected to allude to, was we focus on cloud. That's one of the areas of expertise that Touchstone provides. I feel that companies shouldn't have servers in a computer room any longer. They should be leveraging cloud. Cloud is very, very powerful. I argue cloud is more secure than on-prem. There are many, many benefits to cloud. I have a bunch of facts about cloud and why listed in some of the learning that I do for my employees. And so focusing on a specific vertical that can take advantage of cloud, but at the same time, verticals that are very adverse to adapting cloud because they're worried about security. And so with that in mind, I looked at, and we focus on medical and finance and MSPs, right? Those are the three main verticals that we focus on, but we're not 100% vertical focused. But certainly with my banking experience, having worked at Goldman Sachs and the high security requirements of the banking industry, the credit card industry and venture funds and mutual fund companies, And plus my network, right? Over the years, having worked on Wall Street and so on, I just have a large network in the finance industry. So it just was a natural vertical. And it has its own set of regulations that require its own set of controls. And we are very educated and experienced with, you know, doing audits and assessments and developing information security programs around those regulations. So that was an easy one. Medical, having worked at the Hospital for Special Surgery for 5 years, having the experience in the medical industry and looking at the privacy requirements and cyber requirements for HIPAA, you know, health information, that sort of thing, made it easy. Also, just taking a step back, looking at finance and healthcare, two very large verticals, right? I want to grow the company quick. I go after a large vertical. There's a lot of players. You get lost in the wash, if you will, rather than a really small, tiny niche type vertical where very defined competitors, a little bit more difficult to penetrate in that marketplace, right? So a variety of reasons why I picked these verticals, finance, tech, healthcare, and then MSPs. So the reason why I picked MSPs is I have, you know, in order to secure a computer or a network or a firewall, right? You need to understand how to build one. You need to understand how it operates. And that's IT, right? So MSPs support IT infrastructure. To secure those infrastructures, you need to know how to manage those infrastructures. So I've done a lot of IT over the years. And I understand how IT works and how MSPs deliver their service. What I provide for MSPs, because I've spoken to quite a few of them, I have a lot of business owner friends, their challenges are that they've tried to provide cyber, but it's so different from delivering IT services, even the pricing of it, how it works, how quickly you have to respond. I mean, just there's so many different nuances to cyber because it's really a different mindset. It's starting from a place of risk and applying risk mentality to what you're doing. And it's just not the mentality of an IT engineer. The IT engineer wants to build something. They want it to work. When you implement cyber controls, quite often you limit or break things, so to speak. It's not necessarily breaking things. You're securing things. But it can be interpreted as, oh, I can't go to that. I can't run that software any longer. Why? You know, so it tends to be looked at differently. And so in the IT space, the mentality is different. So we complement MSPs. We provide the cyber component of a cohesive service delivery model, and we'll integrate with an MSP. So if an MSP is using Kaseya, or if they're using ConnectWise, or if they're using their favorite Jira platform, we'll plug into those ticketing systems. If they want us to be white labeled as their staff, we can do that. We work with them. We will help them with change control. That's a big part of cyber controls, right? You need to do a risk assessment on every change that occurs. There's levels of change, right? It could be a small change, changing someone's password, or it could be something more significant like hiring a new employee and going through the onboarding process, or it could be, you know, upgrading from Windows 2012 to Windows 2016, something is like that. Or maybe you're adapting a new cloud-based service and you're migrating away from an on-premises database-based system to a SaaS model, you know, software as a service in the cloud. So we will help IT companies conduct the cybersecurity portion of that project, but we won't conflict with their delivery of migration. Maybe they're assisting or actually doing the migration. So it just depends. But we do go after MSPs, and we provide a service for them to bolt onto the services that they're offering.
Okay. Now, which of the cloud platforms do you favor? I mean, the big juggernauts are the AWS and Azure. Is there one that you favor more than the other, or do you use both?
So we use both. We have consultants that are certified in both. We are a certified partner, Amazon, and as well as Microsoft. We're involved in major projects with both those providers to to a lesser degree, we do Google cloud platform. But, you know, each cloud provider has their strengths and weaknesses, and depending upon what your needs are, your requirements will assist and dictate which cloud provider would make the most sense for your company. And we help navigate through that. You know, we're in the middle of a number of cloud migrations right now. One is with a very large German bank with 1,000 servers, 20,000 employees. They're migrating to Microsoft Azure. Azure has a lot of security features from the standpoint of document management and data leakage and things along those lines. So, you know, I believe Microsoft has made a significant concerted effort to go after the finance industry as a whole. And we just finished a big project moving a co-location facility infrastructure to Amazon Web Services. Also Microsoft servers, but it made more sense to migrate them to Amazon. And one of the things that we do well is the actual migration. And that particular migration, it was about 30 servers, and we cut them over in under an hour. Now, how does that work? That's pretty significant. Well, it's all through very high-end software, right? Well-vetted out software. It's actually multiple softwares. The first thing we do is we run software on all your systems in place, the on-prem, the co-located servers and systems. And this software runs, say, for a month, and it collects data on the compute that's being consumed, and it will spit out reports that tell you this system has way too much CPU. This one doesn't have enough memory. The I/O is a little weak on this one. You have more than you need over there. And so what it does, it paints a picture of right sizing, if you will. And it will also produce reports that say, if you wanted to stay apples to apples, the exact memory, CPU, disk I/O complement that these systems have, and wanted to migrate that into Amazon, what would that cost? Or if you wanted to migrate that into Azure, what would that cost look like? Then we do a second report that says, if you right size and take advantage of tweaking this, that, and the other, it would cost you this, which is inevitably a lesser cost. So that's the upfront analysis that we do on your systems. And then, of course, while we're doing that, there may be some consolidations, there may be some ongoing projects, and you need to – pardon the background noise, sorry about that. But there may be a need to look at ongoing projects, right? Most companies have projects ongoing all the time. Oh, we're earmarked to do an upgrade here. So we need to synchronize the timetable for the migration so that you're not in the middle of a migration. The last thing you want to do is introduce multiple change, because it becomes difficult to determine where things break when you have 5 to 10 or 15 different things changing all at once. But nevertheless, once that's done, we do mock deployments, and they're actually real deployments. We're just not cutting over. And the way we do that is we use software that seeds the data. And this software is analogous to virtualization, right? It's a piece of software. It's an agent. It installs on all your servers. And it basically copies every single change that's occurring on the machine. There's an initial seeding that has to occur. In some cases, that can be done over your connections to the internet or directly to the cloud provider. In other cases, it needs to be seeded with a disk pack. And so we'll provide a disk pack on site. It's basically a really large data store, and it seeds that data store, and then we rapidly ship that to the cloud provider. They transfer that on into the cloud. And in the meantime, any changes between that are queued up, if you will. And so it merges the data back. So I might be getting a little technical here, but the point is that every change that's being made in real time is being synchronized up into the cloud. And that gives us the ability to be able to cut over in under an hour. So for those interested in how do you do that? There's no way you can transfer all that data in an hour and configure all the IP addresses and the firewall rules and the ports and verifying things work and the user accounts and the system accounts and so on. But, it's basically cloning, for lack of a better description, nonstop mirroring, if you will, of your systems in real time. And then you want to quiesce when you're cutting over. You quiesce your live environment. You bring on the new environment. You spend a few minutes before bringing it online, of course, to make sure that it's actually working. And you would have vetted that out. So in the last one we did with the 30 servers, we actually did 5 mock deployments before we did the real deployment on the 6th round. And the variety of reasons why. We were doing actual performance improvements and configuration changes in the live production environment across this time period because there were things that we discovered in our discovery process that just were not optimized, just were not correct. You know, the SQL servers, you know, IP addressing, rules, things along those lines.
Excellent. I got to be honest with you, I'm also blown away by Microsoft Azure, especially. I started out in IT back in the late 90s at the height of the dot-com craze. And when I was doing my MBA, the big thing back then, I think, was the Windows 95, Windows 3.1. And I remember Oracle was a big database back then, too, but trying to understand their licensing scheme was horrible. It was like, what, $3,000 to deploy a, you know, database server. But now here in Azure, you can create an Oracle Enterprise server like in 5 minutes for only like, what, $80 a month. It blows me away as to how much technology has changed over the years like that. And I, for one of my clients, I've written a lot of articles on Azure, and I'm just so blown away by how much they've done to help people come into compliance, like with the GDPR, CCPA, especially. Right now, the CMC, which is the big one of the big buzzwords right now being thrown around here in the cyber world. Now, I'm at your website right now, and I noticed you got a bunch of different solutions, like Touchstone Cloud, Secure, ISP, and the Touchstone Care. Can you just maybe go over those in a little bit more detail for our audience, please?
Sure. So Touchstone Cloud is our service offering that I alluded to a little bit in the last answer to the question about, you know, cloud and some of the approaches that we take with migrating to cloud. So Touchstone Cloud is just our marketing description of how we deliver our cloud service. So we help clients understand what cloud provider to select, whether they go hybrid or not, and walk through the different ways that they can migrate and adapt cloud, how it relates to their cyber requirements, the security requirements, and so on, what the costs are going to look like. You know, quite often it's going from a CapEx to an OpEx, or from a capital expenditure to an operational expenditure model. So there's a serious financial component with respect to cloud. There are regulatory requirements in cloud. You know, we do work for government. We do work for commercial, of course. Most of our work is commercial, but we do have a few government clients, and we understand GovCloud, for example. We work with companies that do cater to the government. So understanding the nuances of how cloud has to be configured and leveraged with respect to regulations is a differentiator for us. So Touchstone Cloud encompasses all of that. And we also provide 24/7 cloud management. So cloud infrastructure is quite different than your infrastructure in your computer room, in your building, in the colocation facility, because it's all about virtualization, right? It's abstract. It's done through software. It's done through portals. It's done through API calls. It's done through infrastructure as code, and we're a big proponent of infrastructure as code. We practice infrastructure as code. So generally speaking, what infrastructure as code is basically the entire configuration of everything in the cloud in the form of a program, lines of code. And what that affords is, I have to use a rather unrealistic example to highlight the what infrastructure as code provides. let's assume you're in the computing region in North Virginia for Azure. They have a facility in Virginia, and it's like a 20-acre campus. And let's say for some ungodly reason there's a natural disaster and the entire infrastructure and building are gone for whatever reason, right? How are you going to rebuild that, right? Well, you could have a completely replicated environment, say in Ohio or in Dallas, but some of their other infrastructure areas, and all of that system could be completely replicated there. That's quite an expensive endeavor. Or you can leverage infrastructure as code, which is the exact configuration in real time of the environment that was in North Virginia. All of the data sets would have been backed up on redundant, synchronized backup solutions across the region. So you're not backing up the infrastructure. You're just backing up the data. It's a lot more cost effective. And then you take your infrastructure as code, which is also, and you rebuild your environment in Dallas. Maybe it takes an hour. Maybe the data restores take a few more hours, but you've saved on the cost of having to completely duplicate the environment in real time and actually pay the compute and consumption costs in Dallas, because you now have a complete instruction set, if you will. So infrastructure as code is critical in cloud, but it's very difficult to keep under wraps because engineers have a propensity to want to make change when they're trying to solve a problem or implement something. And there are ways to, obviously, you can implement cloud without using code. You can go into the console, the Azure console, the AWS console, what have you, and make change, right? That's the design of the console in the first place. So there's more than one way to make a change. You can do an API call to make a change. You can go to the console through a browser and make a change. You can use a tool like Terraform to make a change. You could use an API call, or you can use infrastructure as code in a Git repository. Now, I know I threw a lot of acronyms at you. I apologize for that. But basically, infrastructure as code is software coding, and it requires an expert in coding. And most IT professionals who don't do programming don't understand programming. And so it's quite different from spinning up a Cisco Catalyst switch and programming VLANs and things like that, right? So that is a differentiator in cloud. We practice infrastructure as code. And then the other thing about cloud, which is important, is software as a service, or more likely serverless computing is what I meant to say. So what is serverless computing? Well, in essence, there are servers underlying a service, but it's abstracted or blocked, if you will, from the consumer. So as a company leveraging the serverless computing, what you're actually doing is you're running, say, your database without actually needing to worry about the operating system underneath. That's taken care of for you by the cloud provider, and it's called serverless computing. There's other type of serverless computing services as well, such as in Amazon, a service called Lambda. Lambda basically is a global processing engine that allows you to do things such as monitor and alerting. Another thing you can do is run your stored procedures on your SQL Server data without having to run the stored procedures on the SQL Server. It offloads that, and it significantly increases the performance of your stored procedures. So there are all sorts of services like that that are provided by cloud on top of just the normal compute power that one would associate cloud with. So that's Touchstone Cloud. Do you want me to move on to Secure and ISP and Care?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Sure. So Touchstone Secure is our MSSP / consulting offering for cyber. So we can do auditing assessments under Touchstone Secure. It's basically a cycle, right? We come in, we do an audit and assessment to determine what your risks are, what your industry requires in the form of regulations or standards like PCI, the size of your company, the types of technology you're leveraging. And after that assessment is done, we help you implement an information security program that is appropriate for you, appropriate for the regulations that you need to be compliant with, appropriate for your industry, appropriate for the technology you're using, right? And then once that program is developed, and in doing so, we help select a framework. We're very big on frameworks. NIST has a number of frameworks, for example. There are international frameworks like ISO. There is a lot of different frameworks. And we help the company pick the proper framework that aligns the best with their requirements. And then we implement policies and procedures which become their information security program. And we can help them manage that. And we use software and we use procedures and processes by which this information security program is run. So we can provide a virtual CISO as an example, a part-time CISO, who will help facilitate running the information security program because it's a dynamic living entity. As an information security program is developed, you'll find that you need to implement change. You need to implement some controls. You may need to redesign things. You may need to put some circumventing controls in place because you just simply can't enable encryption in your database for a technological reason. So there's other ways to get around the requirements for database encryption as an example. So we help you determine what those controls are, whether you have them or not. We identify the gaps. We put a roadmap together. You may have some auditing that you're addressing. Maybe an auditor said you're not compliant here, there, and the other way. And what are you going to do to address those issues? So we will put a roadmap together. We'll work with you and the auditor to map that plan out and budget and implement the controls going forward. So at the end of it, you need to monitor and manage that environment, which entails our MSSP offering as well as our vCISO offering. So Touchstone Secure provides all of the actual doing, if you will, of the system. Touchstone ISP, I kind of overlapped that a little bit. I apologize. That's the area where we come in and we do the assessments of your environment. We help you choose the right framework and implement an information security program. Touchstone Secure is, all right, the information security program says that we need to be monitoring these links. We need to put encryption over here. We need to be doing multi-factor authentication over there. We need to do this risk assessment when we go to change this, that, and the other thing. Here's our change control system. We do quarterly reviews, all of these sorts of things. We're maintaining compliance with all the regulations, and we're doing what the regulations dictate. Touchstone Care, this is an area where we may or may not continue to advertise on our website. So we can provide support services, soup to nuts, for companies' infrastructure, whether it's their servers, their routers, their switches, and to a lesser degree, their workstations. We actually outsource desktop support, but we will be the front end for that. So we have a portal. We have a ticketing system that's very powerful. We use ConnectWise, and it's web-based. It's also email-based. It has API capability. And what we do is we provide a one-stop shop for clients. We have certain clients that don't want any other companies involved in their technology, and they've pushed us to do this, and so that's why that's there. We don't really market it too heavily. If a company wants us to do all their IT support, we are prepared and we do that for them.
Okay, excellent. Now let's switch gears and talk about what's happened so far in the last 3 months. It's been kind of a whirlwind with the SolarWinds breach and the Microsoft Exchange Act. Can you tell us what you learned from both? Can you share with us like your experiences, how you help clients, and just what's been going on with both of those things?
Right. You know, before I get to that, there is a whole set of services that I did not allude to. I won't be long-winded. I just want to briefly touch on them. Those first solutions that I talked about, holistic services. We also have some niche services. In the beginning of the call, I talked about ransomware data recovery. We're instrumental in doing that. And the way we do that is we have aligned with number of different specialty organizations or companies. Two companies we aligned with provide forensics, very high-end forensics, that's focused entirely on ransomware recovery. So that's one aspect that we have in our ransomware data recovery service. We also have a relationship with one of the leading U.S. law firms, and we highly encourage companies to – I'm sorry, I'm getting a call here. I just declined it. We highly encourage companies, if they ever get ransomware, to hire a ransomware coach that's a lawyer and a lawyer firm that has experience in this space, and they provide a number of services to navigate through this, because there are U.S. law relating to paying ransomware, which quite frankly happens a lot, and sometimes it's the right business decision, unfortunately, but that's a very sensitive and very important area, is the legal aspect of ransomware. Paying threat actors overseas, if you pay the wrong threat actors, you can get in really big trouble with the U.S. government, as an example.
Well,
another offering in our ransomware is the negotiation process. There's a specialty company, and that is all their business is. They are a third party, and they facilitate the Bitcoin transaction, and then there is the negotiation. And it actually is an art. It is a negotiation. The last ransomware gig we just did, they initially wanted $1 million, and they accepted $72,000. It's an unusually deep discount. You don't normally get such a discount, but it's all circumstantial, and it's all in the negotiations. So it's one of the offerings we have. I'll briefly go through a few others. So incident response, comprehensive Office 365 protection. So when you adapt cloud, and, you know, cloud is sort of two areas of cloud. One is where you run your compute power, you run your servers in cloud, that's Azure as an example. But then there's the other side, which is the Office or Microsoft 365, and that's a whole new area as well, and that requires, you know, security hardening, if you will. So we provide that service, backup and disaster recovery, micro-segmentation, and security awareness training. Security and awareness training, there's a lot of different areas inside that category. Phishing is one of the areas, but it's not the only area. There's also educating your IT staff and so on. So we do that service. So thank you for letting me go through some of those other services. One last one, which I don't have listed on the website. We're very strong in doing forensics on cell phones and providing testimonials and assisting with any investigations, particularly with the FBI. So we've done a number of cases that have gone to court and required expert testimonials with respect to forensics on cell phones and things like that, and working with the FBI on some of this, on some of these cases. So, you know, one could argue, yeah, we do cater to the law vertical, the legal vertical, but it's as a service provider as well.
Excellent. Well,
so,
okay, can you, go
can you repeat the question that I didn't answer? Sorry.
Yeah, you know, it's about the SolarWinds and the Microsoft Exchange hacks. That seems like it's what's making the news headlines these last few months, especially in Q1. What have you learned from that, and what lessons have you applied from that, lessons learned to your clients, perhaps even to your own business?
Sure. So that's two different, completely different scenarios. So we'll start with the Orion scenario. So this has been one of the biggest national security risks, for lack of a better description, that the technology provides. So Orion is a tool that's used by companies to manage their assets, their IT assets. It uses a variety of protocols, such as SNMP, to be able to monitor and manage infrastructure, for example, servers, routers, switches, and so on. And MSPs use Orion to service their clients. So a given Orion install could be managing 200, 300, 500 different companies and it has significant access to those assets, control access, data access, by nature of the security requirements for the tool to work. And in some cases, it's not always configured correctly. And what happened was the software had a major hole in it, which allowed perpetrators to gain access to an Orion central system, which in turn has full control over those 300 to 500 clients. So as you can imagine, they hack one system and then they have access to 300 companies. So it's very advantageous for the threat actors to target these systems. And the Orion platform has been associated with, you know, the SolarWinds company as a whole, but SolarWinds has quite a few different products. We don't use Orion in Touchstone Security, but we do use a SolarWinds product called NCentral. It was an acquisition. It does a different service, if you will, from Orion. The NCentral product also has, and still does to this day, some security challenges. And Touchstone has authored two CVEs in relation to the software challenges with the NCentral product. We're working very closely with SolarWinds engineers and developers on this issue. We haven't published the details in the CVE to protect our companies with respect to that. But what we've done as a service provider is when we rolled out NCentral a year ago, we put our system behind a web application firewall. And the web application firewall is a software tool that looks at the protocol stack way beyond layer 3. So if you're familiar with the ISO stack, you know, layer 1 through 7, we're looking at 4 through 7 with the web app firewall. And we discovered through scanning a lot of challenges and actual vulnerabilities, hence the CVEs that we filed, and we put circumventing controls in place vis-a-vis the web app firewall that we used, and we shared that with SolarWinds, and for the last 6 to 8 months, my developer has been working with their developers to resolve those issues. So any software company is going to have challenges with bugs and vulnerabilities, and you know, the moral of this story is you should protect your systems using software that is designed to do so, such as a web app firewall. You should be doing audits and assessments through the form of penetration testing and vulnerability scans. They're very, very valuable. You should be very, very aware of software patches, their release schedule. You should be monitoring your vendors' notification channels so that you get early warning. There are threat feeds that you can incorporate in your firewalls to block threat actor IP addresses that can also help in these ways. You should not be opening up ports to the internet for anything. Everything should go through a VPN. And if it has to be opened, it should be narrowly focused and filtered properly. And it should be properly monitored with the right software, such as a web app firewall. So that is my blurb on the Orion scenario. And then you also talked about a second hack. Which one was that?
Exchange server hack.
Oh, yes, the Exchange server hack. Well, you know, this is a very easy one. You're running very old software. That's just the answer to that one. You're not patching. You need to upgrade your systems. A lot of companies are penny-wise and a pound foolish. They think, oh, I spent all this money on Exchange 2012. Why do I need to upgrade to 2016? You know, what's wrong with 2012? And so there's good reasons for it. When companies like Microsoft come out with the next major version, one of the things that they're doing is making the product more secure, one would think, one would hope. In the case of Microsoft, that's absolutely the case. What is the vendor doing, such as Microsoft? I'm not necessarily calling out Microsoft in this example. Vendors are focusing on the latest and greatest product that they are trying to get out the door. That's where the bulk of their efforts are being focused. They're not necessarily trying to enhance 2012 when 2019 is already out, right? So there is a reason for upgrade, and this is one of those reasons. right? A vulnerability was discovered. It was discovered and exploited extremely rapidly. And part of the reason is because the threat actor landscape has drastically changed. It's changed into a business model where average people who don't understand, you know, how to hack can simply go into a business portal and purchase hacking as a service. They can purchase ransomware as a service. They can purchase the exploit tools and actually have it run on a platform that they don't even own and just pay a nominal fee to exploit these things. So, and then, of course, you have the state-sponsored actors that are constantly looking to damage other countries' technologies and companies and so on. So, you know, the exchange exploit was pretty drastic because it gave complete access to the server. And these servers tend to be installed in flat networks. I alluded to that earlier. If a company has a vulnerable exchange server, but they had proper segmentation, the hack may not have gotten too far through. But if they have a flat network, once you're in the network, you're in the network. You don't have any other doorways or security checkpoints to go through. And so it can get pretty bad pretty quickly. And ransomware is probably one of the most leveraged tool sets when it came to this exchange exploit, right? They exploit the system for the purposes of implementing their encryption. They discover what's in the environment. They encrypt the data. They encrypt the backups so that they get money. So that it's definitely a financial game more than anything.
Okay. Excellent. Thanks for that for that insight there. Anyway, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the issues in the cyber threat landscape. One of the big buzzwords that's kind of being thrown about there is AI, artificial intelligence. As I told you before our phone call, Rich, my dad was actually a professor of biology at Purdue. He was involved in neural transplantation research. And he said, we will never understand the human brain, how it works. At most, we'll understand maybe less than 0.1% of how it works. People in cyber think that, you know, they can model the brain, mimic it, the thought and reasoning process, but we'll never get there. And so in my opinion, I think there's a poor job discriminating what AI really is, and it's being more used now as a marketing ploy to get customers to buy products, when the AI tool really is not an AI tool. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree with your initial assessment on that and, you know, your high-level description of what it is. AI can be instrumental in certain cases, but in other cases it can only maybe supplement, if you will, what you might be doing. In the compute space, AI looks at, you know, behavior. It looks at patterns. It looks at things that humans aren't necessarily good at, right? Pattern recognition, for example, particularly over longer periods of time. And so in the pattern recognition and heuristics approach to data analysis and, you know, communication across networks and the like, I think AI is powerful. I think there's definitely a place for it and an extreme value. Also with quality, right? When you're looking at what a cyber analysis analyst needs to do, they're processing a lot of data. It's all about whittling down that data. The amount of data that they have to look at is just overwhelming. So the data needs to be normalized. It needs to be culled, if you will. And so AI helps and augments that culling, if you will, by recognizing things that normal algorithms wouldn't necessarily recognize. It can also, you know, learn about the analyst's behavior, what the analyst does within the software. There's a lot of different things that AI can do. I'm not an AI expert, but I do see it as it has its place. I would not say that it's 100%. You can just do AI and not anything else. It's more of a complementing technology or an augmenting technology, and it just that fits nicely in the concept of you know, cybersecurity in layers, right? It's just another one of those layers that has its place and has its value add. And I would say that, you know, it's definitely here and definitely needs to be leveraged. The latest endpoint detection and prevention tools all leverage AI, and they do provide value, and, you know, they do catch things that other technologies don't. So it's real, if you will. And, you know, how far it's going to get, will it ever get to where, you know, some folks think it will with respect to the human mind? I really doubt that. And I just, the human mind is just unbelievable. So I just don't see that happening. But I do see it as an ideal augmenting technology, and it's here to stay, and it's great to have. And there are lots of other industries that it services better. And then there's some annoyances with AI that I'm sure we've all experienced as well. Yeah, it's good technology.
Yeah, because as I said, I just wrote a massive book on that too in print. One areas of AI that can be really useful for, as you've mentioned, is for computer vision, which is recognizing for, you know, unseen objects that the average normal human being can't see. And I think AI is really great for, like, filtering for false positives, you know, so that the IT security team can only see what's real, and they can triage that in much better time. Those are my takeaways. Now, the next thing I want to talk about things. I find this to be a very scary proposition. I'm an old-fashioned kind of guy, Rich, and to be honest, I really do kind of hate technology in the end. I still drive an old-fashioned 2003 Honda Civic, all analog instrumentation. I live here in Chicago. I see all kinds of smart cars, and I don't know how they can start in sub-zero temperatures with all the electronics they have in them. I don't have a smart home. What are your thoughts on that? Do you have a smart home or a smart car?
So I don't think my car is that smart in the sense of calling it a smart car. It has some of the technology, but I wouldn't necessarily call it a smart car with today's definition of what a smart car is, like a Tesla. You know, the technology is going to continue to be adapted and accepted. I think it's somewhat analogous to the, you know, augmentation aspects of AI. In other words, you're not going to remove the human element. The only way you'll be able to do that, I think, in a safe way is to, you know, really change the physical road structure where pedestrians and roads are separated. So I can see where you get on a highway and it's only for autonomous vehicles and it's extremely efficient. And I can see that as a technology that would compete with, you know, this congestion tolling that they talk about. They implemented in London and they talk about it in Manhattan where you have to pay a toll to go south of 46th Street or what have you. I can see where, autonomous vehicles could play in, you know, city traffic pattern and congestion control strategies. I certainly see it in the safety aspects of what it provides, you know, lane drift and watching a person's face to see if they're falling asleep. And in the trucking industry, it's going to be huge. It already is huge, particularly in Australia, where they have these really, really long semi tractor trailers that run these really long roads that are flat and straight. So I see it as definitely technology that's going to be here. Then, you know, you have all the connectivity aspects of smart cars as well, and traffic patterns and things along those lines. But, you know, there's a little bit of Big Brother stuff here too, 1984. You know, you have cameras all around your car now. And, you know, tying that into, you know, law enforcement and privacy issues, it's a complex discussion, but I just don't ever see it being 100%. And I do see it having its challenges from being abused and used for reasons it wasn't intended, like any other new technology. It's going to have a fair amount of that. And then there's going to be outliers, right? You know, that, you know, these systems are not 100%, and accidents are going to occur, and accidents have occurred, you know, and then you have to talk about liability and things like that, and complacency with the driver. You know, ultimately the driver's responsible, right? And so, you know, you have liability and tort reform and all of these things that are going to come into play as well. So complex topic, fascinating technology, you know, and I could see that technology applying to boats and trains and, well, maybe not so much trains, but aircraft and some of these other types of hybrid cars that are coming out, you know, these micro helicopters and these electric airplanes that are coming out. So I think that smart technology as a whole in the transportation industry is definitely here to stay, and safety is, and behavior, human behavior, are probably the two biggest challenges.
Okay, and the next big thing is data privacy. You know, I see on your website you do stuff with this with regards to GDPR, CCP, and the CMMC. The CMMC is, you know, probably the biggest buzzword that's being kind of thrown about right now. I've written a number of white papers and articles for clients on this, and to me, it's still a big murky area. I've not really come across anybody yet that really fully understands what's going on or what the due dates are to become certified. Can you share some insight into this for our audience and kind of clear some things up about this?
Sure. So CMMC, I believe, is going to be the next big embraced standard. You know, there were NIST frameworks that became very prevalent when they first started to come out. There's still a lot of disparity between all the different security standards and security regulations and so on. And so there's been companies that have been very successful in mapping these different standards, and this whole concept of mapping different requirements across different regulations and standards has been a very, very complex exercise, unduly complex, but by nature of these regulations, that's where it's at. I think CMMC is one of the first endeavors to really pull together all of these disparate different standards into a cohesive framework that can be adapted and, you know, try to address the myriad mappings that are occurring out there. So that's the first thing. It's very focused on DOD and, you know, the government, U.S. government. And it's, you know, an area that may not necessarily overlap outside of the United States. You know, GDPR, you mentioned, as a privacy standard in the European Union. And, you know, across the globe, there are standards. Hey, in the United States, every state has cyber regulations now. So it becomes a very, very complex endeavor. Let's say you're a company and you do business in 50 states. Now you have to worry about 50 different regulations or standards, if you will. So I'm hopeful that CMMC becomes a standard that states start to adapt, and maybe to some extent, you know, internationally gets adapted, or at least becomes a reciprocating type of agreement like the SHIELD that was dismissed by GDPR about 4 months ago, unfortunately, for a lot of companies. But so CMMC is something that I think is going to help a lot. And as far as, you know, learning about it and getting certified, so there is a standards body that does certifications, and there are certifications, and I happen to have an employee who's certified. He just recently got his certifications. I have a second employee going through the training right now. So you can get certified. There is training out there. There's a certification body that can provide that certification for you. And, you know, there's a whole tiering architecture with it, if you will, with respect to what level. I think most companies that are dealing with the DOD are going to be at level 3. So, you know, if you're familiar with levels of compliance with other regulations, it has a similar concept. And, you know, the layers dictate how many controls, what type of controls, and how expensive the whole thing's going to be and how complex it's going to be. So that's CMMC. You mentioned something else, and I forgot what it was besides CMMC.
GDPR and the CCPA?
Oh, yeah. So GDPR and other standards. So, yeah, where the United States is behind with respect to privacy rights, and, you know, I think GDPR is a model, and I see it's being adapted by states individually. It would be great to see a privacy act that is, you know, federal, that allows, you know, companies that are multi-state to not have to deal with so many different standards, because it's an expensive ordeal to do that. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of alignment with respect to what we're trying to achieve, right? We're trying to protect the privacy of information that relates to individuals, as an example. So, you know, as these standards like CMMC are developed and adapted and embraced, I hope that lawmakers, you know, pay attention to this and try to leverage it in a way that makes it better for small and medium businesses to adapt these regulations, because it's a very expensive burden for small businesses to have to comply with these things. I'm doing a consultancy job for a one-man insurance shop, and the amount of cyber that a one-man insurance broker has to go through is pretty heavy. So, you know, the small business owner is really feeling it, and I quite honestly think that, you know, there's a lot of skipping, if you will, and, you know, there's a lot of non-compliancy because it's so overly complex. So standards like CMMC and GDPR are encouraging for me. I think they're needed. I think they're important. They can be burdensome, but you know, they're being adapted more and more, and there's a lot more competition in the space with respect to consultancies that help companies adapt these standards. So that's all encouraging for the small business owner.
The next one is, of course, we have to kind of talk about this, is the COVID and remote workforce. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, do you think the remote workforce thing is not going to be a permanent foothold in American society where businesses finally say, hey, you know, let's invest the money that we've been spending in rent or what have you into, you know, into technology and hiring new employees? It seems like everybody's been pretty happy working from home. I mean, surveys seem like Americans are happier. They can have flexible schedule. What do you think? How has it impacted you here?
So from my business, it hasn't been that impactful with respect to my employees doing their work. You know, we're Zoomed out like everyone else. But, you know, we collaborate. We have a lot of tools that we leverage to do so. And, you know, most of the work is easily accomplished remotely. We've leveraged certain remote access technologies to, you know, facilitate some work. And in some cases, you have no choice. You have to go into a computer room to do some work. So, you know, that's always going to be there. As far as overall change, I think that perhaps 20%, 25% change with respect to where folks work. So I'm on the lower end of what folks might think. I'm sure there are others that think, more than 50 to 60% of businesses are not going to have their workers come in. And I think it's going to present its own set of challenges. I don't think it's going to be that high. Like I said, I think it's going to be in the 20s or maybe 30% permanent work from home. You know, there's exploits going on. It's gotten worse. And reasons for that are that, you know, these workers at home are using their own networks. They're using their own connection to the internet, their own firewall, and in some cases their own computers. And they're VPNing in to your office, and they're being exploited. And you know, we're dealing with things even today as a result of a VPN user into an environment getting ransomwared through remote workers. So it's, from a cyber perspective, it's a big challenge. It's a different mindset. It's different technology. Ideally, companies issue war computers, and they're controlled with the proper controls and softwares, and the user of the computer is not an administrator. They're using two-factor authentication. Their VPN is properly configured. They're only given access to the systems they need. If companies aren't doing that, then they're just waiting for something. They're inviting problem. So, but yeah, I think, you know, remote workers, besides the cyber challenges, is the distractions. You know, when I started working from home back in the 90s, it took me 3 years to get accustomed to doing it because it's a different environment. You have family around you, right? You have a natural propensity to walk into the kitchen and get a drink and then start conversing with a family member, things like that. It's not like the pantry or water cooler in the office. It's just a different environment. You know, you may be thinking about tasks, the honey-do list, what have you. So there is that element of it. The second element is interruptions, you know, delivery packages, things like that. Motivation, right? Getting out of your home and going to an office changes the human motivator factor, right? And some people just need to be out of their home. So you do have all types of personalities. Like I had mentioned, it took me 3 years to acclimate to working from home. And so there's a cost associated with that, right? Because you're going to have less productivity. What about productivity? How are you going to measure that? You know, those sorts of things. Collaboration now is different. You know, the human interaction is just not the same over a computer on a camera. It's just not. And then you have the whole demographics of different generations of people, right? Gen X, Gen Y, millennials. They all kind of operate differently. And, you know, I'm a baby boomer, and I like picking up the phone. I don't enjoy having a 20-page text conversation. Even though I'm a very fast typist, I don't enjoy doing that, and it's not as efficient in my mind. And, you know, having a conference call or an in-person meeting with a whiteboard is, you know, one could call it old-fashioned, but that's I'm more efficient in that way. And so you're going to have this, you know, group of people that are all different. And so I don't see the remote worker concept being highly adapted in the 50 or 60% range. I see it on the lower end.
Okay, that's cool. Now, Rich, as we wrap up our show here in the last few minutes, now as we approach Q2 here pretty soon here, what do you think the biggest cyber threat's going to be for the remainder of the year? More ransomware, more things like SolarWinds, Exchange Hack? What's your opinion on that?
Yes, so I think certainly ransomware, and I also see some challenges with cloud providers, right? Microsoft has had at least 3 major outages in the last 3 months. I don't know if you've heard or experienced that. That's quite amazing and shocking, quite frankly, to me. I do hope that that does not continue. AWS has had an outage as well. Then, you know, Microsoft's not alone in this space. And so such large infrastructure companies, the control, the impact of such large environments, having one problem that brings the entire environment down affects such a large amount of businesses that I think that's a big challenge. Ransomware is just a huge challenge. It's growing. And I see that as a really, really big challenge. The remote worker is going to facilitate ransomware attacks, and they're just going to go up, in my opinion. So I see that as a big challenge. I see, you know, the whole political landscape with respect to, you know, talent overseas and, you know, the jobs being available in the United States, the STEM going down. You know, there's less students in STEM programs today, and technology is just becoming more and more prevalent. So, I there's a lot of challenges, but technology provides benefits And I, you know, think that it's an exciting time. I think from an economical perspective, I think the country is going to do well. I think, you know, economies, global economy as a whole is going to do well due to technology to a certain extent. And I think, you know, the cyber challenges that we face are, they're always going to be there. You know, they'll be in the low percentages of taking away the advantages of technologies.
Sure. Now, Rich, as we wrap up our show now, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they're interested in learning more about your services or is a prospect that needs your services? How should they get a hold of you?
So there's a number of ways. One is my website, of course. There's a chat bot there. There's a form you can fill out. You can always email info@touchstonesecurity.com. You can look me up on LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn. You can call our number. It's posted on the website. A number of different ways.
Okay. Well, Rich, we thank you for your time this afternoon, or actually late this morning, early afternoon. We hope to have you again. It's really been truly an enlightening podcast. We really want to have you back again.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. You too. Bye now. Yeah.